Good morning, everyone. I guess it's afternoon, isn't it? Thank you all for coming out on this beautiful late summer day. My name is Bob Clark. I'm the supervisory archivist here at the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum, and I want to welcome you to the Henry A. Wallace Visitor and Education Center. For those of you who are from the area, you will be shocked to realize that this fall is our 10th anniversary of this building being part of the community. Doesn't it seem like it's been here forever? It's become such a part of the community now. Before we get started, I want to cover a few housekeeping details. The first is, will everyone please take out your iPhones and Blackberries and flip phones if you still have them and turn them all off so that our program isn't interrupted today? Thank you. I also want to take a chance to thank a few people who helped put the program on today. Well, first of all, Cliff Lobby, my colleague and good friend, our public affairs specialist, who once again organized a great program, and also our wonderful volunteers Bob Sullivan and Pat Breen, who helped you find your seats today. So let me tell you a little bit about the format of the show this afternoon. Our speaker is going to speak for 30 or 40 minutes about his book, and then afterwards we're going to take Q&A from the audience. Bob Sullivan is actually going to be the man who's manning the mic, Phil Donahue style. So wait on Bob to get to you, or for me to point you out and for Bob to get to you to ask your question. We'll have plenty of time for questions, after which Mr. Walsh will be out by the New Deal store ready to sign all of the books you're going to buy when we're done with the talk here. And then finally, if you will see Cliff after the program, anyone who has attended today, we'll get one of these red buttons, which will get you into our new permanent exhibits for free, and they're open until 6 o'clock, so I encourage you to go see them. They're stunning, they're fantastic, they're immersive, you'll have a wonderful experience in there, and you actually won't want to leave, which was our goal. So let me introduce our speaker. Kenneth T. Walsh has covered the White House full-time since 1986 and is one of the longest-serving White House correspondents in history. He is former president of the White House Correspondents Association and has won the most prestigious awards for White House coverage. He is an adjunct professorial lecturer of communications at American University in Washington, D.C. Prisoners of the White House is his fifth book. Walsh is a frequent speaker on topics related to the presidency, and he often serves as an analyst on television and radio. And I can tell you from personal experience, if you ever have a chance to have lunch or dinner with he or his wife, Barkley, you will have the best table talk of your life. So without further ado, Kenneth Walsh.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you all for coming. Can you hear me okay? Good. Well, I want to acknowledge my wife, Barkley, who's here. Barkley is a professional researcher, and she does my research for my books. She's actually in the back. She likes to survey the scene. I love the presidential libraries. I wanted to say that, first of all, and particularly the Franklin Roosevelt Library. I come here to research my books, and everybody's always wonderfully gracious and very helpful and very professional. So I wanted to say that right off the top. And thank you all again for your hospitality. I've covered, as Bob said, I've covered the White House since 1986. I've covered five presidents now, starting with Ronald Reagan. And people wonder, so why would you write a book about presidential isolation? Well, I've written books about Air Force One. I've written books about the presidential retreats and homes, which include President Roosevelt's home here at Hyde Park. And it always struck me in connection with the latest book, Prisoners of the White House, how abnormal the life of the president is. We live in an abnormal life in the White House press corps, of course, so I'm not exempting us from this critique. But just right from the beginning, when I first walked into the White House in May of 1986 to cover the place, you just get a sense of how strange and often weird the president's life is. President Harry Truman called the White House the Great White Jail. President Clinton called it the crown jewel of the federal penitentiary system. And President Clinton was particularly ill at ease at the White House in the beginning because he had been governor of Arkansas, but he was not an American aristocrat, as so many of our presidents have been. He wasn't accustomed to having household staff and the bodyguards and so on, or so many things done for him. So I remember in the beginning of the Clinton presidency, we get all these stories that President Clinton was a night owl, and he'd come to the kitchen at the White House at 2 o'clock in the morning, wanted to make himself a sandwich, and up, there's a household staffer there. There's a bodyguard at the door. This is at the private residence in the East Wing. So he then complained the next morning, you know, I can make myself a sandwich. I don't have to have people there. It's too intrusive. But the household staff feels that they're there to help the president, so they wanted to do this for him. So they managed to get that clarified. So you don't need the household staff in every other room after 2 o'clock in the morning. Then the Secret Service also becomes a problem for presidents because of the level of security. Since I've covered the White House, I've seen security increase almost geometrically. And it was very strict when I first got there. But every time we have an incident that involves presidential security, or an incident that involves national security of a large enough magnitude, security increases at the White House, limiting the options of the president to interact with everyday people. Reagan's, of course, the assassination of President Kennedy, President Ford had at least two very serious assassination attempts against him. You had the President Reagan's assassination attempt. After each one of these incidents, the security was ratcheted up, and it never goes back again. It always remains as strict as it was then and gets even more strict. After 9/11, the terrorist attacks, the security increased even more. With President Obama, he gets a tremendous amount of death threats. Security increases even more. President Obama was here today, you'd have Secret Service, you know, they'd be sitting in the crowd, they'd be on the sides, they'd be in the back, they'd be in the halls. When President Obama's children go to school, they're in the school, they're in the halls, there's a motorcade. So you can imagine how difficult it is and how abnormal the life of the president's children is. But to stick with the president, he has a notion that President Obama calls it the White House bubble. Very difficult to break out of the bubble. As I say, normal human interactions are very, very difficult for a president. President Obama, and I'll come back to this in a couple of minutes, likes to get out of Washington, likes to try to meet with people. But there's a certain awe and majesty connected with the president which limits what even his staff will tell him. And every president has what I call in the book idolizers around him. It's always been this way. These are people who think that the president can sort of walk on water, but they never want to bring the president bad news. So it's very difficult for a president to get candid assessments of what's going on. And again, this is another point I'll come back to in a bit. But it's a whole notion that you have everything done for you. People, even on your staff, people might say, well, I'm going to go in and I'm going to tell the president he's wrong on this policy or that policy. But when people get into the Oval Office, they melt. They don't do that for a president. And it's part of the whole notion of isolation. And I'll be glad to answer further questions about this if you have any a little bit later. But what I wanted to do is to talk a little bit about sort of bracketing this. In the book, I talk about every president since Franklin Roosevelt who I consider the first modern president, and how they kept in touch or did not keep in touch. But sort of bracketing it with President Roosevelt and President Obama, so I'll focus on particularly because we're here and because of contemporary events, so how they dealt with the isolation of the presidency. George Reedy, who was Lyndon Johnson's, one of his senior advisors two generations ago, wrote a book called The Twilight of the Presidency, and he said one of the most important and least examined problems of the presidency is that of maintaining contact with reality. And I don't think that's too harsh. I think that is really a problem. We talked a little bit about the nature of the problems, but it goes back to the beginning of the country. When George Washington was president, they debated what to call the president, how to address the president. And they decided to come up with a series of possible names. One was to refer to the president as His Highness. Another one was to refer to the president as His High Mightiness, which I think sounds like sort of un-American, doesn't it? And George Washington said, well, Mr. President will be just fine. And that sort of set the precedent. But it shows that from the beginning there was this sort of tension between considering the president sort of an everyday person and reducing the imperial nature of the presidency and the notion that this is our national leader, the only person that represents all of us, and to treat the president as this elevated figure. And that's at the core of this problem of isolation. Now, I wanted to get back to Franklin Roosevelt for a little bit. I know President Obama talks a lot about the letters he wrote. And I know a couple of years ago when I was first thinking about doing this book, our archivist and other folks here talked about how Franklin Roosevelt had letters that he read and that mattered to him. And I found a lot of letters through the wonderful online services of the library are very poignant. A lot of people wrote to President Roosevelt about polio, because of course he had polio, and they were aware that he had it, although I'm not sure many people realized the extent of his disability, because his legs were paralyzed, which you can, of course, see in these wonderful exhibits and at the museum here, illustrations of that. But people were aware he had polio, and there's these very poignant and moving letters from mothers of children who had polio, little children themselves, 7, 8, 9-year-old kids, saying, you know, I know you have polio, Mr. President. I have it, the child would say, but I take inspiration from you. The mother would say that too, that you're struggling against your disability. And one reason I talk about this in the book and now is because Eleanor, President Roosevelt's wife, said that if it wasn't for the polio, if it wasn't for the struggle that Franklin Roosevelt had to go through, again, this is a man of privilege, a man from the American aristocracy, if it weren't for that struggle, he would not have been the empathetic public figure that he was. And a lot of people feel that way, that this sort of changed him and made him understand the struggles that Americans were going through, and it connected him to people. And this is one of the points that I raise in the book about how a president can avoid the isolation of the White House, and that is to have a sense of empathy. Some people have a gift for this. Some presidents don't. And President Roosevelt did learn this. You might have seen the movie Warm Springs with Kenneth Branagh. This is illustrated here in some of the collections about President Roosevelt and his going to Warm Springs, Georgia, to take therapy for his polio. And down there you can really see the sense of empathy very clearly, because all his self-protective moments dropped when he was down there. When he was at poolside, and this is a rehabilitation facility that he made into a place for children basically with polio, he would go down there and didn't want the country to see the extent of his disability, but there are pictures of him at poolside, and you can see his legs, not being able to use his legs, how withered they were, the strong upper body. But he would go into the pool and he'd teach the children the therapy techniques that he learned, never learned to walk again, but did try, and he felt that his example of perseverance would be helpful for the children to learn in their own lives. The President of the United States struggling against polio. So he'd go into the pool. You can see home movies essentially of him in the pool. And in Warm Springs, they didn't call him Mr. President. They called him Doc Roosevelt, because he tried to take care of the children. And he learned that. I think some people feel that he learned the sense of empathy that carried over into his policies. He would visit in this area. He'd visit people in the area who were having hard times. People feel that this is where he learned that Social Security would be very important. He knew elderly folks here who needed help, and so this was all part of that sense of empathy that I think did connect Roosevelt to the country. As I say, he used letters. He had a person on his who advised him named Hadley Cantrell, who was a pollster. And this is another thing I talk about in the book. Polling has become important over the years for presidents as they tried to stay in touch. And Roosevelt understood this. Polling was sort of in its infancy as a serious social science at the time, but he understood that polling could be helpful, so he tried to attach himself to that. But I think that one of the most important ways that Roosevelt stayed in touch was through Eleanor, his wife. Because of his disability, he was unable to get around the country as well as he wanted to. So Eleanor served that purpose for him. She served as his eyes and ears, as they said at the time. And she would travel all over the country. You can find cartoons and references to somebody. First of all, to Eleanor and all the places she went. She went to coal mines. She went to migrant labor camps. She went to visit many poor communities. Eventually, she visited a lot of military bases. And she reported back to Franklin about what she found. She was sort of a combination of a news reporter and a pollster and a partner. And part of the reason it was so successful for the Roosevelts is because it helped with their relationship, because they had a strained relationship. So Eleanor felt that after she went around the country learning about things, learning how what the country needed, learning how her husband's policies were going over, she could sort of bond with him in a professional way by briefing him on this. So they'd have dinners at the White House and here at Hyde Park, and she would explain what she had found on a fact-finding mission. And she'd have voluminous notes that she took, what she saw, people she talked to, and Franklin would help, because he had been a very keen observer before he had the polio. He said to her, for instance, if you go to a place that's taking care of elderly folks, don't just rely on the menu they give you and assume that that's being served to the people. Go to the kitchen and look in the pots. Find out what they're really serving that day. So he gave her a lot of guidance. She became a very astute observer, and this kept Franklin in touch with people as well. And I think the first ladies often do not get the credit that they deserve for keeping the presidents grounded and for telling the president things that other people will not tell him. The whole notion of how President Roosevelt kept in touch, you can see a number of the exhibits here. My wife and I saw the movie here, and you saw those moving images of after he passed away in April of 1945, where his funeral train left Georgia and was heading up north, and all the people that lined the route. And the very particularly moving moment in Washington, D.C. at Union Station, when a reporter asked a mourner who was waiting for President Roosevelt's funeral train to arrive, did you know Franklin Roosevelt? And the person said, no, I did not know President Roosevelt, but he knew me. And that was a very common thing at the time. This man of privilege did not have a lot of interactions with everyday people for much of his life, then became known as the man who understood America very well, and in many ways he did. So on the one hand, we have Franklin Roosevelt, who I think stands out as a president who was able to avoid presidential isolation in many ways. And so that's one side of the bracketing here. I'll just fast forward a little bit, and we'll talk about President Obama a little bit. And then we'll get to some other presidents in a moment. But President Obama, I think, makes a serious effort to stay in touch with the country. I have interviewed President Obama four times now, as I've interviewed all the presidents I've covered. And if you talk to him in person, a lot of people are surprised to find that you don't find that charismatic, sort of exciting leader that you see in his public speeches, that you see in his addresses from the Oval Office, for instance. In person, he can be quite diffident and even distant. He just doesn't like to reach out to people except for his staff and his friends and his close advisors. And a lot of people are struck by this, not only the media, but also other heads of state, leaders in Washington, members of Congress, business leaders, that he's very no-nonsense. He is, in person, many times comes across as the law professor that he once was. Just as an example, the last time I interviewed him, I went into the Oval Office and other presidents would say, how's your wife? How are your children? Largely, this is good staff work. You know, your daughter's in the Peace Corps. You know, this is easily, can be easy found out. All he said was, I've been thoroughly briefed. Let's have your questions. And a lot of people are a little taken aback by that because they want a little bit something more personal from a president. It's just a political thing, but it's also a personal thing. President Obama doesn't do that, but he does try to stay in touch, I think, in a larger sense with people, even if in his person-to-person contacts, which you hear a lot of criticism of, he's not the engaging figure that some people want in Washington. Just another point on that is that President Obama has been meeting with members of Congress who he's been criticized for staying distant from. He's been having dinners with Republicans. He's been playing golf with the Speaker of the House, and so on. But the problem is the relationships. Now we're in the fifth year of his presidency, and he doesn't have a lot of relationships with a lot of people in Congress or in Washington. Now, you wonder if it would make much difference in that so many people in Congress don't like him and don't like his policies and probably wouldn't cooperate with him anyway. But on the other hand, even for people who are his natural allies, there's a sense that he's not as engaged personally as he should be. But in other ways, he is. And one of the points I make in the book and that I leave with you today is that I think staying in touch has to be a priority of a president. There's a number of ways to do it, and I think President Obama is trying to do it. The letters. I talked about President Roosevelt reading letters from people. President Obama gets, they tell us, about 40,000 communications a day from the country. Letters, emails, people trying to reach him on his BlackBerry, which is very difficult. From that number, his staff will filter out everything but 10 letters they'll give him a day. They try to find letters that reflect what's in the news, what people are thinking. They say that some of the letters are criticism of him, some of them are not. But he does take it seriously. He goes back from all indications I've gotten. He reads them every night, reads them during the day when he has a few minutes. Often he reads them to his wife, Michelle, and they talk about what people are saying, and a lot of it is economic hardship. A lot of it is people who have been touched by the wars we've been in recently, Iraq and Afghanistan. And so that's all something that passes across his desk, and I think he takes it very seriously. I had the opportunity to talk to a senior staffer who's left the White House recently who said that the letters are a pain in the neck for the staff because every morning he'll have responses, and he'll demand that the staff follow up. This person is not getting a Social Security check in Des Moines, Iowa. Why not? And so that morning, five White House staffers will be on the phone with that person. And I imagine the person might be kind of surprised that the letter actually got through and that there's the follow-up. But they do take the letter seriously. So that's a case where there's a direct comparison here with Franklin Roosevelt, where President Obama does take communications from the country seriously. The White House polling operation today is the best that I've ever seen. You saw that in the campaign where President Obama and the Democrats and his campaign completely outfoxed the Republicans because their polling understood the electorate so much better than the Republicans and Mitt Romney, who was the Republican nominee, much more than they did. And that continues today. I just noticed that President Obama just gave us some remarks in the last 48 hours in which he talked about how Republicans, this was actually his radio address, I'm sorry, that he just recently gave yesterday. And he said that the Republicans won't even follow up on constituents who want service in getting help from the Affordable Care Act, which is the health care law, Obamacare. And President Obama said this was outrageous, that even if they oppose the law, they should help their constituents get help from the new legislation. Just last week, I was talking to a pollster who said exactly that. That comes exactly out of a poll and a focus group. Those exact words. So the idea that it's outrageous that Republicans won't even perform constituent service for people who want some benefits from the health care law. So I'm not saying that critically. I think presidents should be in touch this way. But it just showed, and I think this was inadvertent, that I was able to match this up with somebody who's very connected to the White House polling operation. But it comes right out of polling and focus groups. And I think that the president has been able to glean a lot of very important information about the country. In the book, I talk about some of the amazing techniques that they used in the last campaign to stay in touch through survey research, which is a section of the book that I think you might find interesting. But it's sort of another effort that Obama's using in his sustained campaign to stay in touch. Another is traveling outside of Washington. He said during his first that one of the mistakes he made during his first term was being confined to the White House too much, and he's trying to correct that. He's about to go on a bus trip. He's just been on vacation for a week at Martha's Vineyard. He's going to be going on a bus trip. Lots of presidents like these bus trips because they give the impression of being connected to everyday people, but at least the president is trying. It's very difficult to connect on a bus trip or any other trip for a president for the reasons I've given, but at least he's trying, and I think that's worthwhile. He's met with families in their homes. He has tried to connect that way. It's very difficult, as I say, because of the awe that the presidency strikes in people, but he's making the effort. Another is the social media. President Obama does surf the net. He has communications through his BlackBerry and his iPod and other ways where people could communicate with him around the country. A very limited number of people, but at least he's sort of breaking out of the inner circle here and trying to hear from people who are not just locked into Washington. And I think that's good. And another thing the presidents do that I think is smart, in particular, and President Obama does this too, is they try to keep in touch with popular culture. And we had lunch today, we were talking a little bit about presidents and popular culture, and President Obama does try to do this. I must say President Bush tried to do this before him. Other presidents have tried this with more success than others. President Clinton was a tremendously interested guy in popular culture. He would surf TV into the wee hours. At one point I found out that one of his favorite shows was something called American Gladiators. Did you ever see this show? This is a show where people would compete against these very strong-looking athletes in very skimpy outfits, I might add. Then they get a prize at the end if they beat him at these tests of strength and stamina. He loved that show. I'm not quite sure why, but he did. But he did try to keep in touch with popular culture. He knew movies. He knew television shows. He knew music. It was just quite remarkable, the breadth of his attention to popular culture. And I think that's good that presidents try to do that. President Obama tries to do that, too. And particularly he tries to do it in two ways. One is sports. He feels that he's interested in sports. He's interested in, particularly in the Chicago professional teams. When he went to, of course, he lived in Chicago for many years, was a legislator and a senator from Illinois. So he tries to keep in contact that way through the sports. He likes to pick winners of the college basketball playoffs and so on. But I think there's two reasons for that. One is he feels like he's sort of connecting to some kind of a guy thing with the country in sports. But also I think it looks good that people feel the president is paying attention to sports. So I think he's got two reasons for doing that. And the other thing that President Obama does, I think that's very interesting, that keeps him connected in some ways and that he tries to use for a larger purpose to project, to promote something, is if you notice, there's an extraordinary number of black entertainers and figures who go through the White House these days. President Obama is the first African-American president. I think it's sort of below the radar, but President Obama and his wife Michelle are trying to introduce the country to a wider range of African-American experience than they've been accustomed to before. If you look at like the pictures that are taken of President Obama, there's always, whether it's a military group or whatever, children, there's always a very strong contingent of African Americans in the background. And I've talked to some people at the White House about this, and it's part of his effort to remain connected himself to the African American experience, but also to project it to the country that the White House is everyone's house. And this is particularly important to Michelle Obama, the First Lady. I wanted to stay with the First Lady for a little bit because we talked about Eleanor Roosevelt, and there's something of a parallel with Michelle Obama. Eleanor, as you see here at this wonderful facility, was very active in many ways as First Lady, and Michelle is very active too. You probably are aware of her campaign to fight childhood obesity, pro-nutrition, the White House garden, which apparently is having some effect. There's some indications that, particularly in minority families, that people are taking seriously her concerns about nutrition and childhood obesity. And so that's one example of how it's making a difference. But also privately, Michelle Obama will talk to the president candidly about what he's doing. If the staff won't tell him he delivered a lousy speech, she will. And he tries to have dinner with the family every night at 6:30, and he most of the time is able to do this in Washington. At those occasions, and I think it's very good that presidents do this, they listen to their families. He listens to Michelle. He listens to Sasha and Malia, his two daughters. And it's a very grounding experience for him because they don't really pay attention to the president as the world leader or the guy who is given an address on health care or the economy. Their comments are like a teenager might talk to any father. My teacher gave me a B, and I deserved an A. The boy I like isn't interested in me. Maybe it's because of all the Secret Service guys out in the hall, but in any case. So it's a very grounding thing, and I think that's very good for presidents to be in that situation, and President Obama certainly is. So I think he does try, and I think that's a very important thing that I'll come back to in a moment. Some of the prisoners who lost touch, very briefly, and then we'll take some questions. President Lyndon Johnson, of course, came into office after President Kennedy was assassinated. He had been vice president. I think he was in touch with the country initially, but then as time went on, he lost touch, largely because of the Vietnam War and because of a lot of the programs he tried to implement, the Great Society and so on, were the country was turning against him. They felt he was going too far. But the Vietnam War, I think, is largely what turned the country against Lyndon Johnson, and I don't think he understood the depth of opposition until he left office. But certainly he got a wind of it toward the end of his presidency, where he was almost literally a prisoner of the White House. He could not give speeches in most campuses in the United States, in most big cities of the United States, because the protests would be so virulent and often violent. And you remember the protest chant that people came up with against Lyndon Johnson was, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" Now, we talk about the harshness of our politics today. That's pretty harsh in the late 60s. And Lyndon Johnson, after he left office, said he didn't really understand how much hatred there was toward him until he left the White House, and it was largely over the Vietnam War. President Nixon, who succeeded Johnson, was one of the most isolated presidents we've ever had. President Nixon was not really a very much of a people person. You wonder how he got elected in the first place, but he did, very unusual circumstances, of course, in those days. But toward the end of his presidency, he was also isolated because of the Watergate scandal, because of the Vietnam War. He closed himself off more and more to people and was just dealing with a very small number of advisors at the White House, which closed him off even more. So it was a vicious cycle with President Nixon, who, of course, had to resign from office because he was about to be impeached over the Watergate scandal. But another case of a president who was isolated. And then I also wanted to mention, I talk about, as I say, all the presidents in Franklin Roosevelt, but the other one who managed to be isolated was Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter came into office with great promise, with great hope, but as time went on, this is a case of a president listening to his pollster too much. Pat Caddell, who you can see on TV sometimes as a commentator, I'm not sure he's a Democrat or a Republican these days, but he was a senior advisor to President Carter, and President Carter relied on Caddell almost exclusively for information about the state of the country and public opinion. Caddell overdid it. Caddell was much too entranced by his own brilliance and gave Carter many, many memos. Carter was entranced by Caddell's brilliance, and in the end, there was a famous moment where Caddell worked behind the scenes. He became a real inside player to persuade Carter in what became known as the malaise speech. He didn't use the word malaise, but he portrayed the country as being in a malaise. The country was having a crisis of confidence in itself. And after a while, people started to think that Carter, largely because of that speech and Caddell, the pollster's influence, that Carter was blaming the country for Carter's own shortcomings as a leader. So by the end of his presidency, Carter also was isolated from the country and in some ways a prisoner of the White House in that sense. Just as a concluding couple of thoughts here. So how does a president break out of the bubble at the White House? I have in the book, I list some sort of prescriptions, and I'll just go over them briefly for you now, and then we'll take some questions. First is remember your roots. Remember what you've learned earlier in your life. For Franklin Roosevelt, it was not so much his upbringing as a man of privilege, but it was this experience with polio, the challenge of struggle, how that bonded him to so many Americans. President Clinton understood his roots as well. Lower middle class guy from Arkansas, he always understood the places that he came from. President Reagan, you might be surprised to learn also, even though he's criticized for being a president for the wealthy and for corporations and so on, he did try to reach out. He always remembered his middle class roots in Illinois as a young man. He was a lifeguard, did a lot of sort of all-American things earlier in his life. Always felt that he had an understanding of middle-class life. I've got to leave it to you to decide whether that was right or wrong, but he felt that way. And while he was in office, he had a tremendous correspondence himself with people that we're now learning about. Many thousands of letters he received and wrote, excuse me, that you can now see in the bound volumes. One thing that particularly struck me about Reagan is during his presidency, he went to a local elementary school in Washington, D.C., and asked the principal to give him a pen pal, an elementary school student. The principal came up with a young student named Rudy Hines. Reagan secretly visited Rudy Hines and his family. Rudy Hines was an African-American in Washington being raised by a single mom. Reagan visited them secretly, and we found pictures of this. It's Reagan and Nancy, overdressed, I must say, in this little apartment that Rudy Hines lived in with his mom. They're eating dinner on tray tables, on a couch, and Rudy is sitting on the floor with what looks like a piece of luggage or something that they have some food set out on. And it's a very interesting moment, but Reagan kept up to contact with Rudy Hines. He had the family over to the White House secretly. He bought Rudy Hines tickets to a Michael Jackson concert, took him to the circus, and people are very surprised to hear about this because it doesn't comport with the image we have of Ronald Reagan as this president of the elites, but he did try. And so that's part of what I'm getting at in the book. The presidents who try to connect are doing a lot better than those who don't. Another point I make is make use of the pollsters, but don't overdo it. Carter overdid it. I think Obama is handling it right. He has a skepticism of polling, but is understanding that polling can help him understand where the country is and what's going on and what people want from his administration. Talking to people outside of Washington. This is very important. It's difficult because of, I say, this factor of awe that the president inspires and a difficulty for interacting with real people because of security and other reasons, but it's important that the president keeps trying, and I think that's very important. One side note to this is that I've always felt that it was very important for the president to keep in contact with military veterans who have served in our military conflicts. Every president who's done this regularly, I think, has been better for it, because I think the best way to do it is to do it privately. You don't hear a lot about this, but it's inspirational for a president to see the level of commitment that our military has, particularly wounded warriors and their families, and it's very moving for a president to see this. It's very difficult for a president to deal with these soldiers who have been wounded and sometimes very grievously. But it's very important for the president to see the impact of his military policies on the actual soldiers. So I've always thought that was very important for presidents to do, and President Obama is doing this as President Bush did and as his predecessors did. Listen to Congress. It's polarized, but presidents can learn from Congress, particularly the members who are willing to help the president. That's becoming less likely today because of the polarization, but it's still worth doing. The ex-presidents are an interesting resource. I talk about in the book as well. And they have a tremendous amount of knowledge and experience in dealing with things. And I think we can make more of an institutional use of our ex-presidents as our longevity increases and more of the ex-presidents are still around and might help an incumbent president. And then finally, don't ignore the media. I don't say this just because I'm a member of the media, but presidents more and more don't feel that they can learn very much from the media. President Bush, the father and son, did not pay much attention to the media. They just felt that they were sort of a pain in the neck. But I think things can be learned from the media, especially if a president expands his horizons and looks across the board, not just at the media that support him, but the media that are critical and the media that may be down the middle, which I know is increasingly difficult to find these days, but it can be done. So in conclusion, I think the isolation of presidents is a serious problem. I think that some presidents understand it better than others. I think President Obama understands that he has to keep at it to try to avoid isolation. I think President Roosevelt felt that way as well. And I think half the battle is a president has to make it a priority to stay in touch, not make it a sporadic thing. And I think the presidents who do that are best able to govern which is what they're supposed to be doing. So with that, I'd be glad to take your questions, and we'll go from there. Thank you very much.
In the next presidential campaign, some of the people who are running will say they're outsiders and they're not from Washington, and they will accuse somebody of being from Washington, and that's why they shouldn't be elected. To what extent do you think with President Obama or any president, it's important to have a relationship beforehand, and has it hurt him or hurt other presidents?
To have a relationship with the people, with leaders of Washington?
Having been in Washington, having worked with Washington people, rather than being outside.
Okay. You mean for president, for the next president?
That's correct.
Yeah. I think you all heard the question. I think we were just talking about this, actually, exactly this at lunchtime today. The best example is probably Hillary Clinton, who's going to, from all indications, run for president the next time. Hillary Clinton has many, many connections to Washington now. Is that a help or not a help to her? Initially, we would think now that it's going to be a help, but I think the question is going to be in 2016, does the country want to go back to someone who not only has a lot of experience in Washington, but who has a lot of baggage from the past? Or we want someone fresh and new. The outsider has a tremendous appeal to Americans in our politics. Part of the reason Reagan was elected because he was a Washington outsider. He was a Western governor, and in many ways he introduced the country to a lot of Western ideas, having been the governor of California and a conservative leader. But the strength of an outsider is very important. To some extent, President Obama benefited from that in 2008 when he ran against Hillary Clinton in the primaries and defeated her, because in some ways she was the insider, he was the outsider, even though he had been in the Senate for a few years. But he did benefit from that. I'm not part of the old network. So I think this is going to be an important issue in the next cycle, and I tend to think that the appeal of the outsider is going to be very strong next time. I'm very reluctant to predict, for instance, how Hillary Clinton will do, although I think she will be stronger than she was in 2008. So I hope that addresses your question. Hurt the president. Well, you know, once a president takes office, I think a president has to rely on people in the government if he is an outsider or if she at some point. And so, and President Obama did do this. One of the reasons he picked Joe Biden as his vice president is because Biden is an insider. So I think this is what you're getting at, the idea of President Obama taking office as an outsider, how much that hurt him when he took office. I think that he did have a strong staff, particularly in the beginning of the first term, and it was very important that he have that, particularly on the economic issues, because you remember we were in a financial meltdown that I think was alleviated partly because he followed some of the policies of President Bush, I must say, in helping the financial industry. But at that point, President Obama was essentially an outsider in many of these issues, foreign policy and the economy, and it helped him to have a very strong team around him. You can argue whether that team is stronger or weaker today, but he had to rely on the insiders in Washington, as any outsider has to, as long as, but the argument is that the outsider then will have a better overview of what's needed rather than just going along with the inside Washington people. So,
what happened to Rudy Hines?
I'm sorry?
What happened to Rudy Hines?
What happened to Rudy Hines? Well, Rudy Hines is now, I think he's working for the public school system in Washington. He's an adult. When Reagan passed away, he was very complimentary of Reagan. He said he never wanted to talk about his correspondence with Reagan, but he felt more comfortable doing that when Reagan died because he felt it would not be made a political issue. But this is now a relatively young African-American man who speaks very highly of Reagan, and felt that Reagan, he was always surprised that when he wrote Reagan, Reagan would write back for many, many years, even after he left office. So it's actually a very interesting story.
Yeah, you say Obama's spending a lot of money on polls and everything else, and I'm wondering, with NASA, or NSA rather, keeping track of all our websites and all our phone calls, he's got the perfect poll there. He knows what website's getting hit. He knows
right.
What people are calling and what country. He's wasting money with the polls he's got in his lap.
Yeah, well, I mean, the surveillance issue, I mean, it's just amazing what is being kept track of now. I mean, I suppose, you know, that's there's the argument that they have to do it to stop the bad guys, the evildoers, the terrorists. Costs a lot of money, but a lot of it is out now because of these leaks. And so, again, I'll leave you to judge whether it's good or bad that this has been disclosed. But certainly, I think Americans were surprised by the level of surveillance, and we don't really know the full cost of it yet. I'm not sure we will, because a lot of it is secret. But it's just constant, and I think a lot of Americans are troubled by it. But in a lot of ways, President Obama has built on the surveillance programs that President Bush started, which a lot of Democrats are uncomfortable with. But on a lot of national security issues, just to wind up on this point, President Obama has adopted many of President Bush's techniques. One particular problem, in addition to the surveillance, which a lot of Americans are troubled by, is the use of drones. I don't want to get too far away, because drones are very controversial, and we're killing many civilians around the world by use of these drones in an effort to kill terrorists. I think the more comes out about that, even more than the surveillance, I think people are going to be troubled by that. But the core of it is that President Obama has adopted many of the national security policies of his predecessor. Yes?
Regarding President Bush and President George W. Bush, as you were talking about personal feelings, getting out and touching Americans, being one with them, I don't think they did a great job. I think they enlisted their wives to do it. In fact, C-SPAN has been having sit-downs with both wives and honored people coming in, Lady Bird Johnson's daughters.
Right.
And we see a different way of reaching the people. I think that was way more effective than what they did. What are your opinions, please?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. I didn't have a chance to go into the Bushes in detail because of our time constraints, but President Bush, the father, had a very strong wife, and privately, Barbara Bush was much more outspoken than we ever knew during the time that they were in office. And Barbara Bush did not, as they say, suffer fools gladly, didn't like a lot of the advisors around her president. We never knew the extent of this his presidency, but he might have been better off because, of course, he was defeated for his reelection in 1992 by Bill Clinton. Perhaps if he had listened to Barbara Bush more, it might have worked out better for him, because I think she understood the problems people were having with the economy better than he did, but I don't think he listened to her as much as he might have. For President Bush, the son, Laura Bush, I think was very careful not to sort of upset him. She was trying to be so much more supportive of him. I don't think she was as much of a sort of a truth teller or a carrier of bad news for him that she might have been. As I said before, some first ladies are much more willing to ground the president and speak truth to the president and criticize the president. Others are not. And I think it's a well-taken point that perhaps the president, those two, Bush, the President's Bush might have been better off listening to their wives more, or perhaps Laura Bush might have spoken up more in speaking the things that now she's saying she was troubled by at the time when they were in office. Yes, sir.
There are, as you know, accusations of media bias. You're right there in the belly of the beast. What are your reactions to those accusations?
Funny you should ask. A lot of my talks, I tell people I'm one of the old school reporters. I'm not a pundit. I'm not a commentator. I'm not an editorial writer. I hope that by the end of my talk you don't know my politics. I think that's one reason I've been able to cover the White House for 27 years, and I try not to mix that in with my coverage. But I do think that there is a liberal inclination in the media. I think that if you see polls, I did a poll on this once myself for a book called Feeding the Beast, We're the Beast in the Media, The White House versus the Press. And most of my colleagues in the White House press corps said in the survey I did of them that they were Democrats and had voted for the Democrat in the most recent presidential election at that time. I think part of the reason is for that liberal tilt is the background of reporters tends to be from Democratic families and so on. But I must say that the other side of this is that, and I think it's more important than the political views of reporters, is that once a president is in office or once a candidate gets to the top of the pyramid, there's this tendency to pull them down, no matter what their politics are. Because the media, we tend to build people up and pull people down. I think this is just a fact of the way the media operate. And we do that to Democrats and Republicans. So if you look at the history of our politics, Jimmy Carter had tremendously bad press, particularly toward the end of his presidency. He was a Democrat. Ronald Reagan had bad press. I remember he got a lot of positive stuff for a while, but then he started making mistakes at news conferences, and we started to point that out, and after a while we do tallies. Reagan made 7 mistakes at the news conference last night. But after a while, we look at polls, and the country didn't care. The country felt things were getting better. They didn't care Reagan didn't understand his own policies, because they felt something's working. So why rock the boat? If you look at other cases, Joe Biden had terrible media coverage when he ran for president twice. Gary Hart was thrown out of the race because of his bad media. He's another Democrat. Bill Clinton had tremendously bad coverage during that Monica Lewinsky year. He was impeached. So the Democrats get bad coverage, too. President Bush, the son, got bad coverage. It's just a matter, I think, the media will just turn on you very quickly once you have power, because it's the sense of the media as a watchdog or an attack dog, which is sort of bred into us who have been in the media for a long time. And I think that actually overcomes the liberal inclination of the media, this notion of building you up and then tearing you down. It's sort of almost a bias against power, actually, is what it amounts to.
I'm going to take a point of privilege since the mic was passing my way. President Obama's evolution on marriage equality was one of the most important moments in the movement. It was a real turning point, but one feels that he came to it reluctantly. How much do you know about who influenced that decision? Was it the family? Was it friends? Any insights there?
Yes. It's interesting. The marriage equality and the whole concept of our perceptions of gays in our culture has changed incredibly rapidly. It'd be hard put to find another issue or perception that's changed as quickly as this. I remember talking to some Republicans about 5 years ago or so. They were predicting this. They were saying, you know, the culture is about to go into a seismic shift on this, partly because the whole notion, excuse me, of being a homosexual or gay person has changed. People, we know too many people who are gay or homosexual or lesbian. There's not this sense of threat or predatory sense that people had long ago. And I think a lot of people now feel, well, at least civil unions are perfectly appropriate. Now, in some areas of the country, that's more difficult to make that case than others. But it's been a tremendous change. I think for President Obama, you know, he comes from, despite all the talk about him being a Muslim, which is wrong, he comes from a rather culturally conservative church background in Chicago. Not on social policy, where he had a lot of liberation theology, but on to the cultural issues, such as the issue of being homosexual. And it took him a long time to get to the point where he felt that he could see the need to change. So what he has done is he's done to undergone an evolution, I think partly because, frankly, Joe Biden moved him in this direction. I think Valerie Jarrett, one of his senior advisors, an old friend from Chicago, moved him in this direction. But I think he has now seen this as a moral issue, similar to a civil rights issue for African Americans. That, I think, is what turned him on this. He felt this was the next step in our evolution as a free and equal society to move into the issues of sexual preference. And he sees that as a continuation of the civil rights movement from African Americans. I think that was a pivotal understanding for him when he got to that point. And now, of course, he's completely shifted. He was very reluctant to move on that issue, but now he's not.
Thank you for your presentation today. The president's going to be in western and central New York in the coming week on an education agenda. He's going to be met by people opposed to his natural gas drilling position. Fracking is a major issue in the state. I'm just kind of curious how you see that playing out in terms of him.
The impact
protesters would have on him and his position.
I must say that I don't think protesters have much of an impact on President Obama at all these days. I think he is much more of a cerebral guy. He'll figure these things out himself. The big environmental issue that's coming up now is this whole notion of controlling climate change that's going to go through the EPA. That's what he's focused on now. But I think as far as how much he's influenced by protests and so on, if that's the heart of your question, I just don't think there's much of that there. I just think he's that's part of his insularity, I suppose. But I think he's just relying on his inside advisors and his own understanding of the issues rather than an outside protest movement.
I'm a little bit surprised to hear you say that the folks on Capitol Hill view Obama as dissident and disconnected from them.
Right.
I think if you look at polls of anyone beyond the Beltway, there's a very different picture that people feel he's had a challenging upbringing. But people feel he understands them. They seem to feel very connected to him. I wonder if, I mean, he never had really a very warm welcome in Washington. And when he tries to accomplish anything, he gets a lot of negatives and there's no cooperation and no attempt to work with him. So I'm wondering, is it Obama? Is it the circumstances that he's in politically? Is he really so disconnected and diffident? I'm not sure people would agree with that.
Well, this is I'm talking about the insiders of Washington. I'm trying to make a distinction, and I think he tries in some ways succeeds in connecting with the United States outside of Washington. But I'm saying I'm getting this from Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill.
Have they tried to work with him?
Well, the Democrats have. Absolutely, many Republicans have not. But a lot of Democrats say, you know, he's been in office for 5 years and I haven't heard from him a single time. And these are committee chairmen. So it's not just the Republicans who feel this. Now, maybe he could never have gotten along with Congress. Now, he did when Democrats controlled Congress, of course. But even in those days, the feeling was he was distant in that he let Nancy Pelosi, excuse me, and Harry Reid run his legislative operation rather than coming up with his own bills. He would let them run it. Now, he got health care through. He got other things through. But there was a concern that he wasn't as hands-on as they wanted him to be. Now, I take your point that a lot of Republicans didn't want to work with him, and that's still true. But I think that if you look at his polling numbers, even just polling the numbers that came out at the end of last week, his numbers on the economy are not good. He's below 40% of people who approve of his handling of the economy. Now, his job approval rating is hovering in about 40 to 43%. Now, Congress's job approval rating is 11%. So they're much, much worse. But the result is that people are just unhappy with Washington. And I think, yeah, sure, people feel, by and large, we prefer President Obama to handle a problem rather than the Republicans in Congress in many cases. But the overall sense of things is that people feel that Washington is dysfunctional, that President Obama, no matter how hard he tries, is unable to break us out of this, and the Republicans maybe get more of the blame for it, but the fact remains that Washington can't seem to get anything done. And you're going to see that this fall in just constantly as we go through the debt ceiling, as we go through the budget issues, more efforts. The House has tried to repeal Obamacare 40 times now. Then it goes to the Senate and it dies there. So these battles, nobody wants to give in on the core stuff. The Democrats and President Obama don't want to cut the budget that much, but they do want to raise taxes. The Republicans don't want to raise any taxes, and they want to cut the budget very strongly. that's where we're at stalemate. And neither side wants to give in on it. And because of the way Congress is constructed, a lot of these people who oppose Obama's policies, even though the nation may support him more, in their districts, they're safe. And so unless Congress changes, we're in for a much longer stalemate than the one we already have, unfortunately.
In terms of presidential press conferences, how does the quantity per month under the Obama administration differ to previous presidents? And then you also mentioned the welcome to African-American glitterati of music and entertainment at the White House. I'm wondering to what extent that actually, in some sense, helps President Obama, or if it doesn't, not exactly significant whether they're African-American or not, but doesn't necessarily or encourages the impression that he is enthralled to a celebrity elite.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Not to mention
those are two very good questions. On the celebrities at the White House, he has to be careful of that because Americans have this bifurcated notion about presidents and Hollywood and the celebrity culture. We a lot of Americans live in and pay attention to the celebrity culture, but President Obama, in some cases, might be going too far in being absorbed by the celebrity culture. Now, he's a celebrity president himself in a matter that President Bush, the father, and the son were not. President Clinton was, in some ways, a celebrity president. They were part of the celebrity culture. People wanted to know a lot about them because they were interesting people. President Obama has done a lot of things to participate in celebrity culture that his predecessors did not do. He shows up on Leno. He shows up on Letterman. He does The View, the TV show. He does Jon Stewart. It used to be the presidents didn't do those shows because they were thought to be below the dignity of the presidency. President Obama is perfectly willing to do those shows. I think on this he's right, because presidents now have to go to where the people are, and people who watch those shows are not the people who may pay attention to news conferences or speeches. So I think other presidents will do the same thing. You might have noticed that Michelle Obama, by remote satellite feed, gave out the Academy Award for Best Picture. That's new. So she's being part of several celebrity culture, too. I think there's a fine line. The president has to be careful of diminishing himself, and the first lady diminishing herself by being too much a part of that celebrity culture. I think Obama is right on the line now. On the other question about the news conferences, President Obama holds fewer news conferences than a number of his predecessors. President Reagan didn't hold a lot of them, but when he did, he made them big extravagances, and we were very much in the press corps look forward to them as big news events. President Obama holds relatively few news conferences. His staff says, well, he gives a lot of interviews, which he does. I don't particularly mind that he doesn't hold a lot of news conferences. I'll come back to that in a second, because I get interviews with him. I'd rather have them to myself than to have them at a news conference where everybody gets the information I get at asking a question. But the quick point about the news conferences is it's not so much the paucity of news conferences, and there are relatively few. But even in a news conference, I'm used to a president, going back to Reagan, calling on 20, 25 reporters. President Obama calls on 12 at the maximum at a good clip. Generally, in an hour news conference, he gets 10 or 15 minutes of an opening statement, which in many cases is the whole point from his point of view, to get access to the country unimpeded for 10-15 minutes. Then suddenly you have 45 minutes left. He's going to call on all the networks that cover the news conference live. That will eat up 4 or 5 news conferences questions right there. You call on the wire services, that's 7. He'll call on an African-American reporter, that's 8. He'll call on a liberal blogger, that's 9. Okay, now we in the press corps are getting nervous. He's gotten the 9 questions, he's only going to have at the maximum maybe 3 more. Then he'll call on somebody he knows is going to, not that the question has been given to him in advance, but he pretty much knows that if you call on the reporter from Buffalo, you're going to get a question about U.S.-Canadian relations in some way. Okay, that's pretty easy. There's 2 left. Now, he hasn't gotten to the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, U.S. News, Time. So everybody is now percolating in that room, all the reporters. You know, I'm here. My bosses are watching. He's not going to get to me, and he doesn't. And the White House doesn't care because they feel that The media are so fractured that he has many ways to communicate with the country, and the news conference is just one way. So after just about every news conference, the press corps is in an uproar because he's only called on 12 people. And many of those people have asked three or four questions, especially the network people. So we're at each other's throats in the press corps. So that's a little behind the scenes about the news conferences, but it's a very unpleasant experience now for a lot of reporters because so few of us get called on.
How much is the race of the president an issue? It seems to me that the old Republican white guard don't want a black man to succeed as president.
Well, we had this question all through the 2008 campaign, and just shortly after President Obama took office, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, said his number one priority was to prevent Obama from being reelected. Now, obviously, that did not work. But we've always had this argument, and I wrote a book called Family of Freedom about presidents and African Americans in the White House where I talked a lot about this. We can't really quantify this. I mean, certainly there's still racism. There's still a sense that a lot of people have not gotten used to the idea we have a black president, and people just cannot get past that. When I asked President Obama about this himself, and he said that he thinks he benefits about equally from people who hate him because he's black and people who love him because he's black. He gets like 98% of the black vote, and that's not going to change. That's one reason why his job approval has not sunk lower, because he has an absolute commitment, even though a lot of African-American activists feel he's not delivered on an agenda for African-Americans as much as he should have. African-American voters are very devoted to President Obama. He also has a lot of support from Latinos, not because he's black, but because of his policies and the opposition to the Republican policies. But as far as the race issue goes, I think that it's probably a wash. Now, you're going to see this tested in the next few weeks. August 28th is the anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech that Martin Luther King gave in 1963. President Obama is going to address a commemorative rally that day. Now, he's already talked about race substantially more in the first few months of his second term than he did in his entire first term because of the Trayvon Martin case in Florida where the young fellow was killed by another man in a scuffle, and you all heard about that, and has addressed race in some ways. But now there's some questions about whether he's going to address race more than he has up to now, and I think that will test this concept about how many people object to him because he's African American, if he raises the race issue more than he has before, which it looks like he will do.
I guess I'm addressing more the congressional delegation, the Republicans in office, more so than the voters.
Yeah, okay. Well, as far as the Republicans in office, there's a lot of agitation in the South on the voting rights issues. The Supreme Court has just voided a large part of the Voting Rights Act that has been a cornerstone of the civil rights movement for a long time. You're having a number of southern states. You see North Carolina just pass a legislation that the Republicans pushed through to limit voting behavior, and a lot of people feel that's racist. I think now it's going to state by state, and I think in a lot of states, particularly in the Old South, you're going to have a resurgence of this notion of limiting voting behavior. Again, I'm not a commentator or a pundit, so I don't want to go too far in being partisan on this, but I think certainly there's a lot of conservatives and white Republicans who object to a lot of the civil rights legislation, and they always have. The question is, as I say, whether this will be energize them even more if President Obama pushes further. And the Justice Department is pushing back on this stuff, too, voting rights. So you're getting a familiar dynamic on the voting issues and the civil rights issues that we've had for a very long time now. But how it's going to play out, again, I'd leave you to decide whether it's racism, states' rights, conservatism, or whatever.
Thank you.